What's your political affiliation? Are you a Republican? A Democrat?
I'm not a Democrat or a Republican. I'm just independent.
I usually vote third party.
I'm sick of both parties. So politics is usual.
Most Americans used to call themselves Republican or Democrat. But these days, more call themselves independent. But what does that mean exactly?
This woman's scared of independence.
It's scary because I don't know what they want. You know, they don't really have a platform.
Yes, they do. It's just that they have different platforms.
Don't ask the government for anything.
If you want to talk about the deficit.
And sometimes we're not sure what their platforms are.
I'm a registered independent.
Lately, independents have changed America.
To hell with the old media.
Independents are constantly changing the culture.
No!
But that new culture can be obnoxious.
Sex, violence, and vulgarity have coarsened our culture.
Some want the government to step in and make rules that protect us from the coarse culture.
But tonight, I say no. Tonight, we celebrate independence from government and government controls.
And now, John Stossel.
For the last 100 years or more, two major political parties, Republicans and Democrats, controlled American politics. But wait, look up ahead. Something is coming. Okay, that was a heavy breathing book promotion for this new book from the Reason Foundation's Nick Gillespie and Matt Welch. Welcome. So, we have fans here. But what was that video about? Independents are going to fly over America and rescue us from the Republicans and Democrats?
Independents are everywhere, and they're becoming the largest single voting bloc in the country. And by many polls, they are the single largest bloc. And in the ones that not that where they're not, they're still growing, and they can determine every national election and every state level election for state office. So, independent voters, people who refuse to say I'm a Republican or I'm a Democrat, that's where all the action is in contemporary politics.
And we have some poll numbers on that. Some people think the government should promote traditional values. Others think the government should not favor any particular set of values. Which comes closer to your own view? 50% now say the government should not promote values. 40% 10 years ago. I think that's a little scary. Most people used to think the government should promote certain values to people.
Look, I mean, a government is a blunt instrument. It is the most blunt instrument that we have. They have the guns. They have our money. We are a more variegated nation. We are all different people. There is no one set of values that defines Americans right now. Our strength comes from the fact that I have different values than Nick, thank God. You know, we all have different sets of values. And so that's not what the government should be doing. The government should be protecting us, should be adjudicating disputes when they come up, but they should not be imposing a set of values on people who don't necessarily agree with
them. And I think what people have seen over the past few years, and especially in this horrible 21st century we're living in so far, where government has tried to take over various industries and done nothing with them, or has bailed out so many businesses that were totally in hock and were starting wars everywhere, people are willing to start to say, hey, you know what, just like a business in a recession has to get back to basics, it has to get back to its core business, the government has to, and the government should be doing less things, and it should be doing them more effectively.
And the title of the book, other than being sort of a bad pun, what are you trying to say?
People right now who the Tea Party is the best example. Compare the Tea Party to the kind of Howard Dean anti-war movement. The Howard Dean anti-war movement became subsumed within the Democratic Party. Howard Dean became the chairman of the Democratic National Committee. The Tea Party has kept an arm's length, has said, no, we're not going to be Republicans. We are right-wing, but we're going to focus on the growth of government, government spending, deficit, and debt, and that's it. We're not going to talk about social issues and other things that divide us. And by maintaining that independence, they have retained power because they seem to Republicans like crazy people. They said, we're going to nominate people who have no chance of winning, but if they hold our values dear, we are going to back them. And when you do that, when you are not a bought vote, when you can't be depended on, then suddenly the parties have to actually compete for your attention, and they start taking your issues seriously at long last.
But how do they retain power, usually? Because the independents probably won't get elected.
Well, it's not a question of independents getting elected. In the 2010 midterms, you know, almost 90 new Congress members showed up, most of them Republicans, many of them endorsed by the Tea Party. So it's not, when we say that the two-party system is broke, we're not saying we're going to start seeing a third party or an independent set of independent candidates who will win. The party structure, because of the way the Constitution is structured and a first-past-the-post electoral system, we're always going to have two major parties like we have in American history. But the what those parties stand for and the candidates they put up will be different. Rand Paul, you know, senator from Kentucky, a Republican senator, he ran against Mitch McConnell and the Republican establishment in his state to win the nomination from an establishment Republican. He went to, you know, on election night when he won, he thanked the Tea Party. He didn't thank the Republican Party. And in the Senate, he's pursuing a different kind of platform than a typical Republican would, but he's still a Republican.
And we have had one president who was an independent, at least one, George Washington.
Okay, yeah. Although then he became the figurehead for what became the Federalist Party. So,
you write in your book, we need independence not just in politics, but from politics.
And this gets to really the core of the book. In the political arena, and when we look at the places where government either directly controls or heavily regulates things like K-12 education, healthcare, retirement, things are going poorly. Elsewhere in our lives, when you look at the kind of explosion of culture and offerings on the internet, when you go to a grocery store where you would go to a produce section, and if you were lucky 20 years ago, you would see one eggplant, you know, in an exotic store. Now in the crappiest supermarket in America, you'll see four or five or six varieties of eggplant plus all types of different things. Outside of politics, when we get independent from politics, things are going great because people can experiment, they can innovate, there's a lot of creative destruction going on. Politics is a zero-sum game. We should squeeze down the places where we need a consensus to the smallest area possible, because all the interesting stuff happens outside of that.
And let's break that down. You talk about education, entitlements, health care, just education. Recently, they're fighting over should they teach evolution in schools. They have to fight over this because it's run by government.
Yes, and I mean, the essential number, which you've talked about, I'm sure, once or twice on your program, is that since 1970, we have effectively doubled, or it's even 2.5 right. times, the real cost of education per pupil, and the success line is exactly the same. We are throwing good money after bad in these systems, and all we're arguing here is put that money in a backpack, let the student walk to the school, figure it out from there, inject competition into these old sclerotic markets.
But competition does two things. It's not just that the government's incompetent and hasn't raised the scores, but it's also that you have to fight about anything
right.
controversial.
Anytime that you have the government trying, you know, expressing anything, it's a battle of values over something. If a government is supporting an art show, you know, people who find that art offensive have a legitimate claim. If a government buys, for crying out loud, which they do constantly, a new baseball stadium, well, my wife hates baseball, so how is that fair to her, right? So anytime the government is involved, it is a values question. And it provokes these fights that are actually pointless to the tasks at hand right now. And the task at hand is this country is out of money. Every city, state, everything is out of money. The federal government, it's a crisis that we have right now. So stop with all this useless crap.
And the reason it's a crisis is two of the areas you talked about run by government.
Right.
Entitlements and health care.
Yeah.
And also,
well, and you can say education as well, and wars and all sorts of things, but there's no question that healthcare spending, the government already spends about 50 cents of every healthcare dollar. And one of the lessons you can learn from these, realms beyond politics, where innovation happens, is that, you know, when you look at eye care and when you look at certain types of dental care that is not regularly covered by insurance, which means that customers are paying out of pocket, when you inject market signals,
it gets better and cheaper.
Yeah.
It's amazing.
I mean, you know, our contact lenses are cheaper and better than they were 20 years ago, or our glasses were 40 years ago, and it's because we're paying for it, so you've got to deliver a good, cheap product to a lot of people.
Let me have a copy of your book for a moment, because I want to ask about
your... Okay, well, this is for sale, though, John, so...
your weird book promo of this thing flying through the air, you know, it's based on this movie Independence Tomb.
Yes.
But that didn't work out so well. It's like your book is going to attack the country.
You know, that movie made, like, a couple of $100 million, so I think it did pretty well, and it did show... And this was controversial in the 90s, but it showed the White House being blown up by an alien mothership. And it was a controversy because audiences around the country spontaneously clapped. And what I think that showed was that people, you know, politics is blood sport. You know, it ain't beanbag, whatever that means, or that expression, but it's blood sport, because what it's saying is 51% of the people get to tell the other 49% what to do, how much to pay, where you have to show up. And people don't like that. And it doesn't have to be
that way. Most of life, in the private sector,
that's right,
everybody gets to pick what they want.
That's right. And, you know, there are troubles and trade-offs, but it's like going back to the grocery store. You know, if somebody starts selling stuff you don't like, you don't hold a rally and you don't try and get a bunch of people to vote to make them change it. You go to the next grocery store, and then if, you know, or the next grocery store, or you build your own grocery store. It's hard to do that with schools right now. It's hard to do that with health care, and it's hard to do that with retirement.
Well, thank you, Nick and Matt. Stick around. We'll come back to you. But next, what does independence mean in my business? You know about the Acorn scandal. I'm ashamed to admit that a source brought the Acorn expose to me, and I didn't put it on the air because I worked at the wrong place. I'll explain when we come back. Now, continuing on the theme of independence, let's talk about my business. After working for an NBC station, then CBS, then ABC, I finally declared some independence and came here to Fox. And here I'm much more independent. They let me say stuff here. So I'm glad Fox exists. I'm even glad CNN exists. More choice is good. It's easy to forget that just a few years ago, there was so much less choice. For most of my career, for a story to get on national TV, it had to be approved by the stuffed charts at ABC, CBS, and NBC, maybe PBS. That's about all we had. Cable channels changed that. And now an even bigger change has happened. Anyone can bring us the news. Bloggers cover stories the mainstream media ignore. So do people using YouTube, Twitter, and so on. And my next guest has expanded this citizen journalism more than anybody. Andrew Breitbart started out working on the brand new and suddenly popular Drudge Report. Then he started his own website, biggovernment.com, which helped take down Acorn, and more recently helped take down Congressman Anthony Weiner. So why do they bring this stuff to you all the time, Andrew? How do you get all these stories?
Well, I get the stories that the mainstream media won't cover, and they tend to be left of center stories. If somebody came to me with the David Vitter story or the Governor Sanford story, of course I would do it. I'm passionate about the story.
So anybody watching now who gets something on their cell phone camera and isn't getting somewhere with their local media, if they go to biggovernment.com, you'll may spread the word if it's interesting.
I go to speeches and I give out my cell phone number. I give my email is andrew@breitbart.com. We were able to break the Anthony Weiner story because somebody tweeted to me at 7:30 at night on the Friday before Memorial Day. I'm incredibly accessible because
But this wasn't a secret story. It was around. Other media had it. They were covering it. They were at first saying, oh, yeah, I believe he was hacked. But it wasn't just your story, but it became your story. How come?
Well, actually, we were the first ones to report that there was a tweet that contained that gray bulge underwear. But it was all night Friday, Saturday, Sunday, Monday, all the way into Tuesday, that the mainstream media tried to stop the story from happening, tried to take his side. Some even called me the hacker. It reminded me of 13 years ago when Matt Drudge broke the Monica Lewinsky story, and for five full days, the media tried to stop the dam from breaking. They can't control the dam from breaking anymore.
And they called Matt Drudge a liar. They said he was making this up just to get President Clinton, and None of those people ever apologized to him, did they?
I'm glad you noticed that as well.
Speaking of the mainstream media, I'm a little bit ashamed of this one, but I'm revealing now for the first time publicly that when I worked at 2020, you, who I didn't know at the time, pitched me with this story about Acorn and the sting, and I didn't cover it. And you remember that, I assume?
Oh, do I ever. I mean, I've referenced it in speeches that I went to ABC to a producer because I realized you can't just break a story on a blog. You have to get the mainstream media to cover it as well. And so I thought, what the hey? I'll call up John Stossel. Seems like an honest guy. Seems like he'd think that the president's vaunted community organizing group treating a fake prostitute and a fake pimp with servants with a smile in every office except for one, I thought, you know, maybe there's a story here.
What did I tell
and
you?
I remember you said that it is a story and that you would probably commit a month to a story like this because it is so blatant, but you said that the politics within ABC were just, you know, that you couldn't do it.
And that's true. I had all kinds of good stories I couldn't get on, but, well, I didn't. I could have had that scoop, and I blew it. So annoyed. But I've moved on from that. And I'm struck by how you are now, as much as anyone, the person the left hates most. And recently you went to this Netroots conference, and they went crazy on you. We have a clip of that.
Have you ever done cocaine? Yes or no?
Going on.
Have you ever slept with a prostitute? Have you? A male one? Have you? Be careful.
Coward! 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 Coward!
So you finally just left. What are they so freaked out about? You're just a guy telling another side of the story.
Well, a week before that, I was being accused of being Congressman Wiener's hacker by the Daily Kos, which is a very prominent website on the left. Its founder goes on Meet the Press. I'm never invited on Meet the Press. I was also called by Joan Walsh of Salon. She's on TV all the time. She accused me of savaging the girl that Anthony Wiener sent the tweet to, even though we redacted her name and didn't make her a part of the story. So the left lies about me while they tell me that I practice bad journalism. So what I wanted to do was to go confront my accusers. And as I got there, they asked me if I've slept with gay prostitutes. No. whether I'm addicted to cocaine, no. And they just went out, they went out of their mind. That guy was screaming crazy things at me. He got security basically to kick me out of the place. And then he calls me a coward, even though I wanted to go confront these people and ask them some basic questions about why they feel that they can use the press and the new media to lie about people on the right like they have done habitually over me.
And just for the record, isn't it the Daily Kos, or is it pronounced Kos or Kos?
Daily Kos, Kos, I don't know.
Okay.
His name's Marcos Melitzis.
Thank you, Andrew Breitbart. Coming up, my next guests say, we're all becoming mutants. Is it true? Do we need to be fixed?
They're calling it a cure.
There's nothing to cure. Nothing's wrong with any of us for that matter.
Putting together a special team with special powers. Join me.
Mutants. I don't hate them. They must be controlled.
Good luck with that. The elites do always want to control things, but in those X-Men movies and in real life, the elites usually lose control and the mutants thrive. Okay, in real life, we don't have real mutants with superhero powers, but increasingly we can create our own personas, express more independence in how we dress, eat, entertain ourselves, even have sex. Anthropologist Grant McCracken calls it plenitude. Nick Gillespie calls this trend the rise of the mutants. So What do you mean, the rise of the mutants?
Well, it goes in with the themes of the Declaration of Independence. In many parts of our lives, we're able to personalize our lives, and you know, you get different types of personal service. You're able to change certain aspects of yourself. When you think of, if you think back to the early 50s or something, you know, there were blacks and whites. Then you have somebody like Tiger Woods, who will put aside the sex addiction for now, but he, when he rose to prominence, he called himself a Cablan Asian, that he was a hybrid of Caucasians, of blacks, of Indians, and of Asians. And that's more what we are. We're mongrelized, we're hybridizing, and we're constantly experimenting and trying out new ways to express ourselves or to show ourselves. And I think that that's part of why the X-Men franchise is so popular now. It's speaking to what we're doing in our real lives. We're trying to express our individuality, and we're trying to play around with different ways of kind of muddling through our lives.
And Grant, you call this plenitude. Why?
It's a sudden kind of explosion of expressive possibility, if you want. I mean, you think about people in the 19th century, Victorians, say, living lives where identities were largely assumed or assigned by class and age and gender and so on. The exercise of a traditional American liberty took the form of people pursuing the right to express themselves in a variety of ways and breaking out of those assigned identities and fashioning their own.
Plato used the phrase plenitude.
He did.
To mean?
He used it for natural purposes. That's one of the things that preoccupied the ancient Greeks, was just how many creatures there were in the world. And he said every time you get a space between two natural species, you'll have a third one appearing.
And you talked about 19th century. There you were either a peasant or a duke, and you did what your parents did. It was just accepted you would do what your parents did.
You know, one of the actors from Grease died recently, and you no longer are stuck in a high school that only has jocks, nerds, and, you know, in hoods. You now have, and Grant has written about this, where you go to a high school now and there are thousands of different possibilities. There are, you know, goth punks who are also Christian, and skaters who do this and that, and B-girls who are really boys. I mean, it's just exploding all over the place.
And why is this good? A lot of people would say, oh, this is evil.
Yeah, no, I mean, people say that all the time. The reason why it's good is because it allows us as individuals to do things that we want to do. And we wouldn't say it's bad to experiment with business practices because we might get things that are cheaper and better and more efficient and more widely available. Why would it be bad to say, as long as I'm not hurting somebody else and I'm not forcing them to do something that's wrong or painful for them, why is it a bad thing to explore all of our possibilities?
Turns out the sky isn't falling. Of course, the intellectuals are quick to accuse us of having created a world in which chaos can only be around the corner. But in point of fact, we've been exercising this personal liberty since the 18th century, and the sky doesn't fall. In point of
people have always said it's going to be the end of civilization.
Totally.
Well, and this is one of the things that's fascinating is that people say, oh, my God, you know, you look at Lady Gaga, and you compare, go back to Madonna, who was this great person who blew up the virgin whore complex, it was called, you know, because women could either be virgins or whores and never the twain shall meet. Lady Gaga is the third or fourth iteration of Madonna, and we don't even care about her sexuality. It's not an issue. I think about Pop-Tarts. Pop-Tarts were created in the mid-60s, and they originally came in three forms, blueberry, strawberry, and brown sugar cinnamon. They looked identical. And that's kind of where we were as a society. There weren't that many options, and the flavors were somewhat muted. Now when you go to a supermarket, you can buy about two dozen or three dozen types of Pop-Tarts that range from those three original ones to all of these brightly colored ones with things stuck on them and occasional brands that, you know, are SpongeBob or the X-Men or whatever. I think it's a better world. It's a more interesting world. It's a more innovative world. And when you take this back to human society, you know, the fact is over the past 30 years, crime rates have gone down. Sex crime rates have gone down. You know, nobody, because they are mulatto, has to feel somehow inferior or disenfranchised from our society. We are more accepting, more tolerant. We are more peaceful. And we get to do things that are really interesting. I get to wear a leather jacket to work. That would have been impossible. You know, 30 years ago. Grant gets to dress, as an anthropologist, you should be wearing like a pith helmet or something, right?
And I have one on, it's just very small.
No, but you know, so we get to express ourselves, and that's generally a good thing.
Generally, I can see people in the audience saying, I get it for Pop-Tarts, it's nice to have more choice, but Grant, for people to break all these traditions that have stood up over time is gonna eventually cause the unwed pregnancy, the breakdown of the family, the beginning of people being less kind to each other.
Indeed, I think it feels more like a kind of generosity. We're sort of accepting of people, whoever they are, whatever they wish to be. There's something slavish and kind of grim about a society in which people take their cue from stereotypes on the one hand, or the elites, the stuffed shirts to whom you were referring in the last segment, and kind of wait to hear how they ought to live their lives. I mean, that's in a culture committed to liberty.
There's a safety and security in that. Now the kids are anxious. They don't know what to do with themselves. They don't have clear role models.
Well, I guess the new role model is Lady Gaga, who says, you know, find your inner monster. And in point of fact, that pursuit of an inner monster never creates, or very rarely does it create, genuine monsters. So it turns out there's an expressive realm here, the exploration of which doesn't create social pathology.
Is that a Lady Gaga lyric that you're quoting?
maybe.
Well, thank you, Grant McCracken, Nick Gillespie. Next, why did Soviet communism collapse? Because of our military, I'm told, or because of our music. Keep on rocking in the free world. Neil Young wrote that song, actually, as a criticism of President Reagan and George Bush Sr. But people in the Soviet Union played the song at rallies against the communist dictatorship. Music, pop culture, is a threat to dictators everywhere. And if we keep rocking, we'll have a free world, says Matt Welch, co-author of the new book, Declaration of Independence. And he's right, say former MTV personalities Kurt Loder and Kennedy. What do you mean he's right? What does music have to do with a free world?
Well, I think it's people in this country take this sort of thing really ironically, like, oh, freedom, what does it mean? When you go overseas, I think that word really has a meaning. When you have a song that states it like that, it's in a different context, and it really has a deep meaning.
My understanding
is... Absolutely. I mean, I think our greatest export in this country... it's not steel, it's popular culture. And I didn't realize that until I went to Japan with my husband, who was my boyfriend, for the first time when we were 22. He was a professional snowboarder. And I went over and I saw the crowds of kids who were dressed like snowboarders. And I realized that skateboarding and snowboarding were as universal as music because it made them feel something. And I realized how international that really was. And I was proud to be tongue-kissing him.
Well, because of statements like that, a large part of the world hates us because of our loose sexual culture.
I said tongue kissing. I didn't say anything below the Levi's.
But that's not actually true. I mean, the world loves us. They don't necessarily love our government. They love our culture. They ape it. In the Arab Spring, which we're enjoying and watching with some nervousness right now, there's a whole subculture of Egyptian metalheads called Metallions, and they've been fighting for free speech to bang their heads. And there's a whole hip-hop culture in Morocco and these places. They love that culture. They don't necessarily love the government.
But just as many people who love that, there have to be as many seriously religious people who think it's evil and hate us because
of it. But yeah, screw them. You know, I mean, this is like Iran. Or the people that dislike American popular culture are not fun people. They're tyrants, they're dictators, and, you know, why should we care?
It would be North Korea, culturally, if we allowed those people to be in charge. And we really never can, because it's about cutting yourself off from emotion and feeling. And, you know, that's what music and popular culture allows you to do. And it's not the people, you know, we've been, I think, really self-centered, thinking it's about American culture, but it's really the feeling you get from participating in these things where around the world they are squashed. I mean, women can't even drive in Saudi Arabia. They can't drive here either. Am I right, people?
Oh. And I was told by the media for years that communism fell partly because of our military buildup. And the Soviets tried to spend, their economy wasn't strong enough, they collapsed. But you say it's a big part of it was our culture.
Part of the reason why communism fell was because of a junkie rock band in New York City who wrote songs about heroin and nihilism.
Communism fell because of...
In part because of this. There's a reason why the Velvet Revolution is called the Velvet Revolution in Czechoslovakia. It's because there was a band in 1968 smuggled in a copy of the Velvet Underground and Nico, a great record that no one here at the time bought or liked. And a band started aping them, playing cover songs of this, the Plastic People of the Universe, they were called. They were arrested by the authorities for disturbing the peace in 1976. Because they didn't get an official license to play their music. Václav Havel recoiled in horror.
He became president of Czechoslovakia.
13 years later, after a long jail stint, he acted in open defiance of his government, said, "A government that shuts down rock music like this is a government that does not deserve to be in power." Signed and created this whole new movement called the Charter 77 movement, which has since been replicated in tons of different countries, including in the Arab world right now, that was based on reacting to government censorship of a rock band that was playing Velvet Underground covers in the Soviet Union. And it was the single biggest factor of sort of civil society that ended up undermining communism in the former East Bloc.
Let's bring it back to America, the show Glee, which apparently threatens some people. You
Why
say it
be
makes
threatened by Glee.
My colleague Glenn Beck, who I like a lot, says it's a nightmare all about self-gratification.
Oh, he's a gum-flapping pumpkin head. He doesn't know what he's talking about. It's a wonderful piece of artistry, and I marvel at what they're able to do week after week. And by the way, for anyone who was a misfit in high school, it doesn't matter if you were a band nerd or a thespian or an in-the-closet jock. You can look at the characters on the show and feel something for them and relive it.
And in a way, I think the self-gratification is what everything is about. Whether we do good or we do bad, or if we give to charity or something, we're trying to gratify ourselves, in a way. So what's wrong with self-gratification? It's loony.
Other example.
John?
I think it's okay.
Where do you stand on that?
The American Family Association says Glee glamorizes homosexual behavior. It can
Hope so.
Turn
done and done.
The kids will go to hell.
Well, no.
We were hearing about this in the mid 1980s from Tipper Gore and the Parents Music Resource Center. A lot of us grew up around that time.
Thank God for Frank Zappa.
Yeah, Frank Zappa and John Denver. Yeah. John Denver was in the trenches too.
D. Snyder.
Rocky Mountain High. Tipper Gore thought this music was satanic. That we were teaching, the Prince was teaching people how to masturbate. And look, the culture, not as a necessarily recorded culture, but just in terms of crime and like general decency, is so much better. If all this
people
music,
don't know that crime is down, unwed pregnancies are down.
New York's nicer, although Kurt's kind of bent out of shape about those tables on Broadway. But it's different than it was before, and for the better. If all this music was coarsening and awful and corrupting culture, then why is the world a much, much, infinitely much more free, prosperous, and interesting place than it was 20 years ago.
And it goes back even further. I mean, in 1954, there were Senate hearings on comic books, because comic books were felt to be destroying the youth of this great nation because they were so gruesome. They were horror comics, and, the country was going to collapse. That
but
hasn't happened for some reason.
Under a certain administration, couldn't you see the same thing happening with video games, though? I mean, couldn't you see congressional hearings on video games?
They had them, and they
come up
proposed
regularly
banning some of them. And I was relieved, I didn't realize this, but it used to be against the rules to show a couple even sitting on a bed, sharing a bed on television, and the TV show Bewitched was the first
really?
Show that did that. And we survived.
It's amazing.
We always survive is the point. All pop culture, popular culture, especially music, speaks to the desires of young people. And young people want to be exploring their freedoms, running against the leash of their parents or their communities. And they're confused about love and these things. It is a self-centered type of art form. That is the point. People need to find their self-expression. It is, by definition, anti-authoritarian. There's a reason why authoritarians hate this stuff, because they know that it works.
And by the way, there are some really great bands out now who follow in the same vein, which is do it yourself, because the music industry really collapsed and allowed people who realized they weren't going to make any money to write and produce their own records from their bedrooms. And now people are able to do that with GarageBand on a Mac.
More of Declaration of Independence. So thank you, Kurt, Kennedy, Matt. Stick around, because on Facebook somebody wants me to say, if you vote Libertarian, you're throwing away your vote. So our audience next will get to question you about that. We're back with our guests, Nick Gillespie and Matt Welch, authors of the new book, Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. First, then, from my Facebook page, they Kerry Wolf basically says, what are you talking about? By voting libertarian, you throw your vote away.
I'm not telling anyone to vote libertarian here.
But for anybody who does.
You know, voting is a totally personal act. You know, people vote to make themselves feel better. Voting doesn't necessarily have a huge impact on things. Our point is...
What do you mean it doesn't have a huge impact on things?
Well, you know, if...
Do you remember the 2000 election, John, at all?
If you live in the District of Columbia like I do, you know, where it's 90% Democrat, you're not really going to affect the way the District of Columbia votes about a presidential candidate, for example. But our point is, declare independence from politics, from the two main parties, choose your own reason to vote or own party or block to support or not support, and from there you can build a more interesting politics.
And the best of life is outside politics.
Yeah.
Always.
Yes, sir.
Yeah, it feels like that for Republicans and Democrats share a lot of blame for the economic mess that we're in right now, yet it seems like there's a revolving door to Washington. Why aren't they being held accountable? Why do they keep cycling through?
Well, you know, I think they are being held accountable, not as fast and not as quickly or definitively as they should be. But Democrats come and Democrats go, Republicans come and Republicans go. What we need to do is to stop the bipartisan bailout economics. We need to stop the bipartisan warmongering that's going on. We need to have politicians who are going to change the way entitlements are funded or even if they exist at all, and how education gets delivered and things like that. And I do think we're seeing change in that because people are leaving the major parties. And they're voting out bums and putting in new people who have a short period of time before they become bums.
In your opinion, why do you think that people who advocate for things like gay rights or abortion rights or gay marriage, they tend to identify themselves as being on the left when it seems it makes more sense for them to be libertarians where nobody cares what they do with their own personal business? Why do you think there's this lack of understanding or this schism that thinks that those issues belong on the left rather than in the Libertarian Party?
It certainly doesn't help that most of the major candidates for the Republican presidency are nattering on about, like, keeping traditional marriage and constitutional amendments to prevent gay people from marrying, with the exceptions of Ron Paul and Gary Johnson, maybe. So there's a reaction to existing politicians who keep talking about it, who keep bringing this stuff up. So that is reason. But you point to something that's totally right. It is kind of bizarre, these collections of politics. Why does someone who believes in fiscal conservatism need to somehow think gays shouldn't marry? What is the connection there? I don't see it at all. And I think you will start to see some of these things split apart, especially as Democrats realize that Obama is a no-good Nick when it comes to the drug war, when it comes to civil liberties, when it comes to Guantanamo Bay, when it comes to waging war. He was terrible on all of it, and that's why they voted for him. So that I think you're going to see a defection from him and a realization you put your faith in a leader. That was the mistake.
You know. All right, speaking of waging war, it's one legitimate role for government, defense, protect us. So from Facebook, Brian Thompson asks, what does a libertarian think about the war on terror?
Well, you know, I'll put it out there. You know, terrorism is a bad thing. It's a horrible thing. It is absolutely legitimate for the government to hunt down and quarantine, destroy, if they're in the act of violence, to kill terrorists. This is not controversial with anybody. What that has to do with the global war on terror that was inaugurated by Bush, you know, after, you know, it makes sense to do that after 9/11. It would have been even better if he had started earlier. With a massive national security infrastructure in place, you know, that they couldn't prevent 9/11. But beyond that, what does that have to do with shaking down grandmothers and infants while they're walking through security airport lines, things like that? We spend billions and billions and billions of dollars protecting us, and most of that has nothing to do with terrorism, and it doesn't stop terrorism. So the war on terrorism is a good idea, but we should clarify what that means.
Yes.
Given our current political system, how can we possibly de-incentivize pork barrel spending and entitlement programs for our politicians?
It's tough.
Yeah.
You know, by supporting people who campaign on it. Find people who agree with you on this and nothing else. And if that's that important to you, then try to effect change, not necessarily by believing in the parties, but by knocking on the door.
You wanted to follow up? Go ahead.
Yes. I totally agree with you guys that we definitely should support people who...
You are a great American.
That's what I'm told. So I totally agree with you guys that we should support politicians that say that they're going to cut spending on all these unnecessary programs. But at the same time, isn't that the only way that they can get reelected time and again?
Generally speaking, don't believe in the politician. Try to find, you know, ways to impact the system from outside of it rather than, you know, supporting a single human being.
And it's worth not being a nihilist when it comes to politics. There are cases, you know, New Zealand did this, Canada did this, the U.S. did this after World War II. They dramatically ramped down the amount of spending, both in absolute terms and in relative terms as a percentage of economic activity. Political change happens.
And they're
doing
better. Canada is thriving and has less unemployment than we have. We're out of time. Thank you, Nick and Matt. Coming up next, they say the future is so bright, you have to wear shades. I'm not so sure, though. My take when we come back. Our future's so bright, we'll have to wear shades. So say the optimists from Reason, but what are they talking about? Look at that. That's how many rules just the feds added last year. 80,000 pages of minutiae that regulate nearly every aspect of our lives. And they do this stuff every year. And this doesn't include the rules state and local governments pass. Every one of these things, every rule in here, this is government force that takes away someone's freedom to do what they want to do. And look at this chart. It shows how much the government spends every year. And it's just growing and growing. It's on a path that's unsustainable. And yet, if any politician sensibly says it is unsustainable, it suggests limiting the growth of the biggest program, his own constituents yell at him. That's what happened to Representative Daniel Webster from Florida.
It's rationing. That's what you want to do. It's ration Medicare.
So given the growth of government and those people's attitude, what is there to be optimistic about? America's on a road to bankruptcy. How is the future so bright we'll have to wear shades? Well, maybe because outside politics, the human spirit and human ingenuity is so powerful it can overcome the stupidity of politics. Look at the good things that have happened outside politics. Today, Americans live longer and healthier lives. Every year, life expectancy increases. We're richer than ever. Despite all the impediments to capitalism, more people are prosperous. And we have better tools. iPods, YouTube, Facebook, Google, contact lenses, EpiPens, life-saving vaccines, and cancer treatments. People like talking about the good old days, but how good were they when you didn't have modern dental tools, flush toilets, and you died young? Also, how good were the good old days for people like Ellen DeGeneres, Ricky Martin, or any gay person? Not very good. In fact, the good old days were not so good for most women. When I was a kid, women had to get their husband's permission to get a credit card or to take out a car loan. As these old ads show, a woman's job is to stay home, take care of the husband and children. A woman secretary of state or governor, not conceivable. And the good old days certainly were not good for blacks or interracial couples. They used to be persecuted. For people like them, life in America has gotten much better. So maybe tonight's optimists are right. Maybe free people will overcome this stuff, these horrible freedom-killing rules, and America will have a wonderful and prosperous future. Sure hope so. And that's our show for tonight. Good night.